I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Tony McAleer joins me now. He has just published a new book, The Cure for Hate, A Former White Supremacist Journey from Violent Extremism to Radical Compassion. It chronicles his middle-class upbringing through to getting involved with neo-Nazi groups in Canada and the United States. The book looks at his involvement in the white Aryan resistance, as well as the methods to which hate groups like that recruit people, mainly young men, to their cause. Mr. McAleer rises to the highest levels in the white power movement, all the while gaining the attention, acceptance, and approval he so desperately craved and was lacking from his early life. I'll ask Tony about the trajectory of his life, as well as how he managed to disengage and atone for his past. We'll also discuss the prevalence of hate in our discourse and more. Tony McAleer is a noted speaker and father of two. He is the co-founder and board chair of the nonprofit organization Life After Hate. This new book is published by Arsenal Pulp Press. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Tony McAleer. Mr. McAleer, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So your book begins with your upbringing, the early years. I mean, it's a struggle into adulthood for everybody, but in your case, you're trying desperately to fit in, the schools that you go to and the sort. As we start our conversation for people listening to us, what was it like growing up? I mean, you grew up here in Vancouver, is that right?
That's right. On the west side, I grew up in Dunbar.
Yeah. And so some people might think that that's a privileged background. I guess growing up in Vancouver is compared to other places in the world. You went to private school?
Yeah. No, my father was a psychiatrist. Like, I came from a affluent middle class family life and went to mostly private schools.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Except for the last two.
And so as I'm reading your book and I'm reading about what it was like for you growing up, now that you can look back at it some years removed, what do you think you needed as a kid?
I think what I needed as a kid was something my father was incapable of giving me because of his own childhood. And that was, sort of, when we look at what love is, it's attention, acceptance, approval. And when we can't get those in a healthy way or from the source that we hope to get them from, we will seek them out and we'll get them from anywhere. And sometimes we can find a positive place to get those things. And sometimes we can find a dark place to get those things. And that's what I did.
And having read the book, I think we should make it clear that there are no excuses in terms of the life that you ended up living. And so I guess you can't even blame him for going into white power groups, right?
I don't blame my childhood or anyone in my childhood for anything. Everything I did, I chose to do, and I have to hold myself and be accountable for those things. But by understanding things in the childhood, I try to help the reader understand the lens through which I made those choices. You know, someone once said to me, you know, Tony, you seem like a nice guy. How did you lose your humanity?
Yeah, yeah.
I said, I didn't lose it. I traded it for acceptance and approval till there was nothing left.
Right, right. And I think that this points to a problem, I guess, in society in which we don't pay attention to the children as we should. And I think that's probably something that you obviously needed, right?
Yeah, and there's all kinds of young people that grow up with those things missing in their childhood. It doesn't mean they're going to join a racist gang or anything like that. It's a lousy predictor. But when researchers look in the history of people that have joined racist gangs, it's almost always there. I think I talk about in the book toxic shame, and that's sort of that impaired sense of self where you believe you're not lovable, not good enough, that you're flawed, you're less than. And we live our lives in reaction to that, and we adopt various coping mechanisms to prove it wrong, to disguise it, to shield it, to hide it, to numb it. There's a myriad of ways at which coping with that leads us into destructive lifestyles. We either project it onto somebody else or we internalize it through addiction, eating disorders, and the like.
So the other kids that you fell in with, What sort of backgrounds did they have? Were they similar to yours, say?
No. They came from more working class, more many had broken homes, and you know, there was more than a few friends of mine that were in group homes, and you know, and I think the punk scene that I gravitated to initially was kind of a magnet for those kids that didn't fit in, but you know, and I think of the two skinheads that became my best friends at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
They were very, very working class backgrounds, and a lot of the people I did meet over the years were pretty damaged in their childhood.
Yeah, you talk about the skinhead identity in the book. You note that, you know, it's very ultra British, jingoistic, being a fan of football, booze. This was sort of the makeup of the groups, and this would be in the 80s, right?
Yeah, and it was it was certainly violent and, you know, not a wholesome youth group to be part of, but it wasn't as dark as it went when the music turned overtly white supremacist.
And the music itself, I mean, the music obviously is of an era, not like today. Did that play a part, say, in I guess bringing you all together, if you will?
Absolutely, and it was a reinforcement of the ideology. Without, you know, for those that didn't like reading books, you could listen to music and get your narrative and your ideology. I liked the music and I liked reading books, so.
Yeah. Now, the one might ask you if this is a conscious journey for you. I mean, do you realize as you're going down the rabbit hole, if you will, into hate, what's happening? I mean, are there people around you who are telling you, hey, this is not what you should do, Tony?
Yes, but, you know, after walking in on my father with another woman and getting, you know, beaten at Catholic school because my grades were failing, or dropping, I had a problem with authority. So there was nobody. Anything, if it came from a position of authority, I would reject it.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's hard to, I got this, I got notoriety and, you know, I mistakenly confused fear with power.
Right.
And, you know, I had a reputation and from coming from that place of powerlessness, as I was every time I had to visit that office to get a meter stick on the rear end, that sense of power was intoxicating. I felt safe with that sense of power.
Yeah.
And I was willing to trade bits of myself away in order to feel safe and have that power. It was intoxicating.
Yeah. And you move up in the organization, if you will. I mean, you become a spokesperson. You appear on television. You appear in Montel Williams, propagating the ideology that you do. As a recruiter, what were the traits that you looked for in somebody that made them a good mark, say, in bringing them into the organization, if you will?
I don't know that it was as cold calculated as that. But there was certainly instinctually, you knew when people were being responsive to it and when people weren't.
Mm.
And then, you know, you'd invite them to parties, you'd shower them with attention, you'd love bomb them or, you know, whatever you want to call it. And for people with that vulnerability seeking acceptance and approval, it feels great.
Yeah.
You know, and they come in and maybe they last a couple weeks or a couple months, or maybe they stay in for life, but you know, once they're in, then let's go out and find more.
What I found fascinating as I was reading your book, Tony, was, seeing what the organizations were like, say, in the 80s and the 90s as opposed to today. Can you draw a line in terms of how different the alt-right is from today as now, or then
right.
as now?
So many of the things that happened in the groups back then still happen today. But there's the internet and social media has ushered in sort of a whole new element, which is the non-thuggish element, the more intellectual. Some of them have never ever met a person in real life that's involved with the movement. That is what is different, and these kids are pretty smart, and I think it's become, you know, almost, I'd say, counterculture.
Mm-hmm.
So these young white men that feel not a part of society or alienated from society, you know, it's funny, they describe themselves as weaponized autism. And, you know, it's not that autism in any way lends itself to white supremacy, but, you know, there was a letter we got from a mother after Charlottesville, and she said, you know, can you help me? I'm really worried about my son. He's 18. He's got Asperger's syndrome, and he's found this white nationalist community online. What scares me the most is that they've accepted and embraced my son in a way that no one else has his entire life because of the awkwardness that came with his Asperger's syndrome. And
that's the
scary part. And these people would never get along with skinheads. I think they actually disdain that brutish, thuggish element of the movement. They see themselves as much better than that.
Yeah.
But it's a new element, and they're young, they're smart, and they're pissed off, and they've got a lot of time on their hands.
And that speaks to your work with your organization, Life After Hate, which you co-founded. I mean, that's what takes up most of your time nowadays, I bet.
Yeah, a good chunk of it. I think we've helped 300 people since Charlottesville, half of them being individuals and the other half families reaching out, you know, because they're concerned about a loved one.
Yeah. The part of the book that I found unsettling and difficult to read, because I'm not white, was when you talk about traveling through the United States and attending these various Aryan Nation groups in the United States and seeing what it's like from the inside. When you write about it today, I mean, you're obviously, it's not a pleasant thing to talk about.
No.
What was it like then, in the moment? I mean, were you, is it something where you're just swept up in it and you buy into it and you just can't see, I guess, the forest for the trees, if you will?
Somewhat. And you know, I think I know the part that you're talking about. And when I went to write that, I tried to put myself back in the mindset and capture the fervor of when I was there. And I know that chapter freaked my editor out a bit, a bit too. And I know after writing those parts, it was I felt like I had this like negative energy on me. It was like get this off of me. I feel icky having immersed myself back into that space of negativity, and I had to go for several walks in the woods, which is that's my spiritual chiropractor's the woods, before I could get it off of me. And it was hard writing some of that. It took me out of myself and out of sorts for several days after. And you know, my fiance was like, you need to go for a walk in the woods. You've still got some on you.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. It was difficult.
Yeah, it's difficult to shake off, and that she can see, you know, it on you, if you will, having just written about it.
Yeah, because like I said, I tried to put myself back in that to accurately describe the fervor and excitement and all of that stuff about something I'm not today, not excited or proud of or happy about happened at all.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting challenge.
Yeah.
But as you get caught up in it and the excitement, it's forbidden. There's a taboo nature of it, and you're breaking all social constructs and boundaries. That makes it more exciting.
Yeah. Now, the Canadian Liberty Net, that might be recognizable to a lot of people, but for a lot of people, I mean, it's over a generation ago when that was in, when that was prominent. Also interesting that it was at the beginning stages of the internet, and your involvement in that was what?
I was the one who made it happen. It was my creation.
Uh-huh.
And that was like a recruiting tool, and you know, from all of the court cases and tribunals and everything, I got a lot of respect from it, a lot of attention, especially from older figures in the movement. And you know, what it was really for me was if I couldn't get that attention, acceptance, and approval from my own father, I would seek out other father figures to get it from.
Yeah, so people like Ernst Sundell, and then Doug Christie was the lawyer at one point, wasn't he?
Yeah, no, he was the lawyer for the whole thing. Tom Metzger in California, and Ernst, you name it. But they were all, they'd all give me attention, acceptance, approval for doing negative things. But I didn't care that it was negative. What I cared was that I got attention, acceptance, approval. And you know, these sort of decisions aren't happening at the conscious level. You know, we don't say, well, I'm going to get some acceptance, but I'm going to, you know, do a pretty bad thing. I'll choose the acceptance. It's just the ego rationalizes things and doesn't, it's, these aren't rational decisions. They're emotional and conditioning responses to get these very basic human needs met.
So, but what about these guys in authority, these older guys, if you will? What motivates them? I mean, if they're at the top of the organization, if you will, in terms of having the respect of a lot of people, at what point then does it not become, say, just looking for acceptance and approval, and it just becomes, you know, hate, if you will?
Well, don't make no mistakes. We can be very hateful in our search for acceptance and approval. This is by no means sugarcoating it or making it okay. It's a, you know, it's a sense of a power to have a following, to have a voice that matters. You know, at the same time, you know there's anger there and there's disconnection there, and you know, if you'd have met me back then, I would have presented as a sociopath.
Mm-hmm.
I would do, you know, I didn't care about what happened to other people as long as I could increase glory, fame, attention, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, that's what I mean by, you know, traded my humanity away till there was nothing left. And, you know, I believe that the level to which we dehumanize other human beings is a mere reflection of how internally disconnected and dehumanized that we are. And we don't see other people as human beings, you know, like the Nazis saw Jews as ledger entries.
Mm.
You know, and you get this cold, dispassionate disconnect. You know, hate isn't a hot emotion. Anger is. But hate is a cold, dispassionate disconnection.
Yeah. So if the book, if one reads the book as a journey to getting better, you do have to hit rock bottom. What was it for you in terms of I guess the worst time for you?
Well, the worst time was I still had to hit rock bottom, but my daughter was born just a little bit before that.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're around that amount of negativity and you surround yourself with people that are just as negative and just as angry as you all of the time, and all you're doing is projecting hate and blaming others for everything, it's impossible for your life to work well. You can't have a good personal relationship with yourself, never mind anyone else. Nothing in your life will be firing on all cylinders, and it's a dark, heavy, negative place to be, and it's exhausting. You know, when my daughter was born and I held her for the first time and connected with another human being for the first time. So it created an opportunity where, and I had the choice whether to take it or not, but for the first time with her, I made decisions for someone else other than myself, because before that, I was a complete narcissist. Everything I did was me, 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 me.
Yeah.
And in that choice, began the thawing process in the choice to remove her from, you know, the misogyny and the anger. It's the last place I wanted to raise a daughter.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a moment, there's a moment in the book, I guess you all as a family go down to the States to Bellingham to shop.
Yep.
And you buy a rifle, and you disassemble it, and you put it in her stroller.
Yes. Yeah. That's that level of disconnect. And at the point my daughter was born, I still had a lot of momentum. Because at that point, the identity and my ideology were intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't what I believed, it was who I was. It was what I thought about. You know, if there was, if I could sprinkle white supremacy on my breakfast, I would have done that too. It was just, it's sort of all-consuming. And it took the thawing of my heart that the children provided before I could separate the ideology from the identity. And that's the challenge when trying to talk to someone who's in this mindset, is if you try to talk ideology with them, you're actually challenging their identity as well. All the ego defense mechanisms pop up. You can't have a rational discussion because you're actually challenging their full identity. And the ego will do contortions and gymnastics to avoid that.
Yeah. This path... away from it all, which you describe in the book, and it's quite moving. It's not an easy road, obviously. It's a long process. It's one that's ongoing, isn't it?
Absolutely. Whenever, I think as human beings, there's always something more to heal. And you know, when we heal ourselves, we heal the world. When we heal the world, we can heal ourselves too. But there's always something in the background that's influencing our behavior negatively. When we find out what that is, then we can go and heal it. The wonderful thing is the world is a mirror and will provide you with no shortage of clues of what you need to go and work on.
And is revenge something that you have found in terms of the way back? Is that something that's a great challenge? Because, I mean, we all have thoughts of revenge, you know, small things during the course of one's day. As someone who was a white supremacist at one point, I mean, one would think that revenge it takes on different forms. Is that something that's easy to get rid of, say?
Once you learn that, you know, I think I can't remember who had the original saying, but, you know, anger's like... drinking a poison and hope the other person gets, you know, dies.
right, yeah.
Right? And once you realize that, you know, forgiveness is not about letting the other person off the hook. It's about letting you off the hook from that negative energy and that anger that holds you back, that hurts you. So in the book, I forgive my father. Forgave the, you know, the teacher that hit me on the rear end all the time, and then also put myself in front of communities that I've harmed and offer them an opportunity where they can be forgiving and release whatever stuff they have. And, you know, and before apologizing to family members and such, saying to them, how did what I did affect you? And then just be quiet, no deflecting, no excuses, and just take it in. And once you start to get a taste of that and how it makes you feel afterwards, or you see the benefits, how it makes other people feel, I learned pretty quickly it's the only way to go. And it doesn't mean that it's any easier.
Sure.
You know, it's hard for me to speak in some communities or to sit there and, you know, nobody likes to be criticized.
Yeah.
Even if they deserve it.
Yeah.
And they've done something wrong, but nobody likes that moment where it's coming in. But it's, you know, I think if this world is to heal and we're to have a better society, it's not going to happen from inside our comfort zone.
Yeah. Tony, seeking forgiveness and atonement, one might think that they're the same thing. They're not, right?
No, forgiveness. I mean, they're interconnected.
Right.
You know, forgiveness, because forgiveness is, again, about the other person. So if I go to the Jewish community and I seek their forgiveness, they can forgive me, and sure, I'll benefit and feel good about that, but that's a process for them. Atonement is about finding ways to make up for the harm that was done.
Yeah.
And, you know, in sort of a restorative justice kind of idea. And that's why I do volunteer all the time, because I don't receive a salary, that I do for Life After Hate. That's part of my atonement. That's why I go and speak to these different communities all over the place. It's part of my repentance, and it's healthy for me to be able to forgive myself.
Yeah.
And it's healthy for them to be able to offer forgiveness to me. And you know, I've just been at some of these events where there's just a great deal of healing on both sides takes place. And these are things that we don't have to be a former white supremacist to engage in these practices. We can do it within our own families. We have to, you know, drop the ego and be able to admit that we were wrong.
Yeah, there's a powerful moment in the book where you're appearing before a group, and there are people obviously who are accepting of your message and who offer you forgiveness, who embrace you, and then there's someone who doesn't, who has their arms crossed, and yet at the same time, you know, when one reads that, it's necessary whether you get what you want to do that, right?
Yeah, I mean, everybody has the choice of what they want to do. I can't expect forgiveness for everyone, but I can give them the opportunity, and three of them benefited from that. Maybe the other guy's not ready. That's fine. If you wanted to yell at me, that would have been fine. That would have been fine too.
Yeah. It's been about 5 years now since Oak Creek. You know, you, Charlottesville, Tree of Life, Christ Church. When events like this happen, and unfortunately they're happening with greater frequency, I guess what I wonder when I hear of events like this is what we can do. Now, you're someone who knows these things from both sides. Is there something that we as a populace can do? To deal with the aftermath of these things, but how to prevent these things from happening?
Well, I think it starts with asking ourselves, where do we put judgment and dehumanization out into the world? You know, and where do we withhold kindness? You know, there's two ways we can operate as human beings, out of love or out of fear. And where are we maybe operating out of fear? I think it's not going to be any grand stroke of the pen or a political savior to come in on a white horse. You know, a lot of this obviously is law enforcement related.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to, are we contributing to the climate of polarization? Are we contributing to the climate of fear in what we talk about in our discourse and how we treat other human beings, whether they cut us off in traffic or, you know, step over them on the sidewalk. And I think if we need to, as much as possible, make sure our actions are coming from love and not fear. And it's like, you know, McDonald's in Vancouver had kale salad for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You go, how on earth does McDonald's have kale salad? Like that 10 years ago, I said it's impossible.
Yeah.
But it happens not because they're told to do it. It happens because of what individuals are putting in their mouth with more and more with every more bite they take. It's millions of little tiny actions that can have that dramatic impact. And I think as long as we sit and think it's got to be one big thing that we do, we can be paralyzed by that. But when we think about who can I be in every moment, inspire other people to be compassionate, to be kind, and to operate from that place of love, we have great influence on the people around us, and it starts there. And we just you never know. I've inspired people who've gone off, inspired people, and they come back and tell me the story, and I don't even know who it is that they're talking about. But
yeah.
You know, we, as human beings, we have an incredible power to influence others. And we have to be conscious of how we are influencing others in every moment of every day.
And I can only imagine with this book, how many people will read this and get something useful out of it. By the way, you talked a moment ago about the process of writing one part of the book. Having now written it, put it all out there, do you think you're better for it?
Absolutely. I think it was a painful process, but I'm glad I went through it, and I'm glad that I was able to share with the world by being totally vulnerable. I mean, there's nothing I hold back in that book. It's very vulnerable. So that they, you know, my hope is that I can set an example of vulnerability, not that everybody has to go out and write a book about all the terrible things they've ever done in their life, but that they can begin to look at themselves and healing and see patterns or elements that maybe happened in their life, but, you know, they chose a different way of dealing with them. I hope it through, you know, my story as almost like a case study, and through the, you know, the way I unpack it with all of the time that I spent in counseling one-on-one in group, that by understanding me, they can better understand themselves. And I think it's an important piece, is the more we have compassion and understand and forgiveness for ourselves, the more we can have it for other people. And vice versa. And the answer is not to go out and fix other people. The answer is to fix ourselves. And that enhances our capacity to influence, inspire, and help other people.
Tony, it's a powerful book a very well-written book at that. Continued good luck with it and everything else. Thanks for this.
Thanks very much.
The book is called The Cure for Hate, A Former White Supremacist Journey from Violent Extremism to Radical Compassion. It is published by Arsenal Pulp Press. Its author, Tony McAleer, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.